やって。
Thank you, Steve, for that very kind introduction. It is a pleasure to be here with you today, not just among colleagues, but among brothers and sisters. I'm going to talk to you tonight about a topic that is very dear to my heart, the one that I spend most of my time studying these days, and that is the issue of climate change. About 5 years ago, my husband and I moved down to West Texas. We used to be in Indiana, Notre Dame. We moved down to West Texas, and I have to admit I was a little nervous. I felt a little bit like one of those missionaries in the 1800s moving to darkest Africa. You weren't sure if you were going to get popped into the stew pot for saying something that the natives didn't like. But I have to say that while there were certainly occasions such as I had feared and dreaded, there were many more occasions where people were genuinely curious. Within a couple of months of arriving in West Texas, I was starting to get questions and invitations to speak to a book club or a Kiwanis club or the university women's group or the church down the street. And wherever I went, I started to realize that people had a lot of the same questions. They had really good questions. Like, how do we really know that this issue is happening? I read and I hear a lot about it, but whatever I hear is very contradictory and conflicting. If we're Christians, how could we believe that God could let something like this happen to our planet? And so, in response to these questions, I've really had to deepen my understanding of this issue, not just from a scientific perspective, but also from the perspective of our faith. If God is in control, how can this be happening? Because there is no doubt, from a scientific perspective, that there is a problem. There is absolutely no doubt whatsoever. Here is how the problem began. Round about the 1700s, we figured out how to start digging massive amounts of coal and gas and oil out of the ground and burning it to fuel the Industrial Revolution. Today, we produce these heat-trapping gases like carbon dioxide and methane from the smokestacks of our factories, from the tailpipes of our cars, from heating and cooling our homes, roughly a third from each of these sources. And we also have gases like methane and N2O from agriculture. With methane, about 90% comes out the front end of the cow, and you can guess where the other 10% comes out. These gases are building up in the atmosphere. What you see here are the amount of these fuels that we've actually burned since the 1800s, and then tracking it, the black line, is the amount of carbon dioxide buildup in the atmosphere. Some of this excess CO2 has gone into the ocean and into the biosphere, but a greater amount has stayed in the atmosphere. It's a very political issue because when you make a map, like I did here, of all of the countries in the world and how much they have produced since 1900, you see that there's one country that has produced 30% of the world's carbon dioxide since 1900. And it's really not fair to put Alaska on there in red. As a Canadian, we're not really off the hook, though. Our per capita emissions are up there in the top three. So are Australia's. These gases trap heat in the atmosphere. It's very clear that carbon dioxide and methane and other gases trap heat. You can do the experiment yourself in the lab, and I did that as an undergraduate. It's a simple matter of the frequencies of their vibrational and rotational bands. What we see happening is that the temperature of our Earth is going up as more and more of these gases trap heat in the atmosphere. This is the average temperature of our planet, measured by thermometers all around the world. The first thermometer started taking measurements in 1659. That's the Central England temperature record. It's an amazing history of what's been going on over the past 400 years. Around about 1850, we started to have enough thermometers around the world to actually calculate a true global average. And when we look at this record, we see two things. First of all, we see that our temperature goes up and down from year to year. That's weather. That's what we remember instinctively with our limited minds, speaking for myself. But the other thing we see is that over the long-term climate timescales, climate is defined as the average weather over at least 30 years, we see a continued increase in our global temperature to the point where the 2000s was the warmest decade on record, preceded by the 1990s and the 1980s before it. Last year tied as the warmest year on record, and it was also the wettest year on record as well. When you look at this long record, you see that our temperature is actually rising faster and faster. Just drawing a simple trend line, It doesn't even include the last year. You can see that a linear trend over this time period, the slope increases. Now, with 25 years, we are pushing the bounds of what you consider climate, cheating a little bit there. But this is just to show you that we're in a situation where things are starting to accelerate. What we see in the atmosphere is just a fraction of the total heating. The oceanographers here know that the ocean has a much greater heat capacity than the atmosphere. And so what we see here is the actual increased heat absorbed by the ocean in blue and by the atmosphere and land, which is what we just saw in the global temperature record back here. That's the part in green. So 20 times more heat has been absorbed by the planet than we see manifested in the global temperature record of air. Our conditions today are unusual. Putting together our instrumental record, that's the red line, with proxy records, many, many different lines of natural thermometers, like stalactites and stalagmites, written records of crops and harvests and dates of freeze and thaw, tree rings, pollen, even fossils. Putting together these records, we see that we have had warm periods in the past, we have had cold periods in the past. But what is happening right now is unprecedented in the history of Western civilization. We have not seen these conditions in the history of what we would call our civilization. We can go back farther with other proxies. When we do that, adding carbon dioxide to the mix here, we see that there are certainly some bumps and wiggles in the temperature record. That's the technical term. But there are no major natural cycles, interestingly, over the last 6,000 years. We picked this axis very carefully because many of the people who argue for young Earth also argue for natural cycles as causing this problem. But if you look over the short term, there are no natural cycles the size of what happened when we decided to industrialize our civilization. Now, using ice core measurements, we can go back farther. Ice core measurements actually go back about 800,000 years now. And if we look at ice core measurements, we see that we have had some very large cycles over the past. You're looking at CO2 here, but temperature tracks CO2 very closely in the past. In the past, changes in temperature actually drove changes in CO2, which then fed back, causing further increases in temperature. This is what happens naturally as a feedback process in our planet. So we have the warm interglacials like we're in right now that lasted a very short time, and we had the long ice ages in between. But what we see right now is our carbon dioxide levels are already well above anything observed in the last 800,000 years, and they're estimated to head even higher. Our world is changing very quickly. Whether it's the fact that our crops are shifting northward, whether it's the cherry trees in Kyoto, Japan, that are now flowering on average 3 weeks earlier than they used to in their 1,100-year record, whether it's the droughts in Africa, some of which are just natural variability, but others of which can be tied to changing weather patterns caused by a warming planet. Or the melting glaciers. This is an image of Glacier National Park. It had over 150 glaciers when it was named back in the 1800s. Today there's less than 30 left. All around the planet, responses to warming temperatures are seen in more than 25,000 physical and biological systems around the world. Some of these likely even in your own backyard. If you've lived in the same place for more than a decade, you probably remember when certain trees or plants flower, what types of birds or insects you see in your yard. These things are changing, and they're changing within our lifetime. We can actually become observers of this change for the first time. What else do we see happening? Well, here we have a picture of the number of days that Greenland was melting in 1979 when the satellite observations first began. And on the right, in 2007. The reason why it's 2007 is simply because I haven't got the updated picture. Not because there's anything particularly special about that year. If I had an updated picture, I think there would be even more red. What's happening is our sea level has been rising over the last century, primarily due to thermal expansion. The simple fact that warmer water takes up more space. Over the last 30 years, our sea level rise has accelerated and doubled. The reason why it's doubled is what you're looking at right here. Land-based ice is melting, and that water is flowing into the ocean, accelerating sea level rise. Why do we care about that? Well, we've seen a sea level rise of about 8 inches over the past 150 years. What we expect in the future due to this acceleration is much larger. We expect anywhere between 2 to 5 feet of sea level rise over this century. Much of it, I hate to say, unstoppable, because we have already entailed that. There's an enormous inertia built into the sea level rise. What does that mean for our coast? Well, the dark red is what we would expect to lose this century. It includes half the Everglades and all of the Florida Keys. It also includes much of Bangladesh's rice-growing area. Up to half of their agricultural land could be lost within the next 100 to 150 years. Even then, though, they would probably consider themselves lucky compared to islands like Tuvalu, where with those 8 inches of sea level rise, when the storm surges come, the waves already overtop the island. The people of Tuvalu know it's a matter of decades, not centuries, before their island is actually gone. New Zealand has agreed to accept 75 people per year, but it's not fast enough, they're worried. The Arctic is changing. Sea ice is shrinking. We had a record minimum sea ice year in 2007. This past year nearly, but did not break that record. It's no secret that we expect an ice-free Arctic sometime very soon in the summer. Last summer, for the first time, two commercial freighters made it through without an icebreaker. Some of these may be seen as good things. Canada, certainly, as well as Denmark and the U.S. and Russia, are jockeying for position. There's an enormous market for geologists like never before, because if you can prove that that part of the continental shelf belongs to you, then you get the resources. So everybody is now trying to claim this region that nobody used to care about before. But there are people who have always cared about the Arctic, and those are the people who've lived there for hundreds and thousands of years. This is a small village called Kivalina. This village was built when the government ships arrived and they found people camping on this frozen peninsula. So they built a school, and people had to send their kids to school or else they would go to jail. And some Anglican missionaries arrived in the late 1800s. And so this entire population is Christian, and Easter is their biggest holiday of the year. They stay up all night from Saturday to Sunday to greet the sun when it arrives. But soon they probably won't be there anymore, because what's happening is the ground underneath their town is melting and literally crumbling into the ocean. Not only that, but the autumn ice that used to protect their village from those storms is arriving later and later in the year. So not only are they missing the protective ice, but also the previously solid frozen ground, permanently frozen ground the town was built on, is melting. People from a different town, the people of Newtok, Alaska, have already been driven from their homes. They are the first American climate refugees. That happened 2 years ago. People of Kivalina fear that they are next. There are over 250 native villages in Alaska in imminent danger. Our water resources are disappearing. This is the glacier, one of the glaciers that feeds the city of Lima, Peru. It has over 8 million people, but only 2 inches of rain a year. Right now, the glacier is melting so fast that they have more than enough water. But they anticipate that the glacier will be gone within a few years, maybe a decade. They're building desalinization plants, but those cost a lot more than free water. Water that flows through some of the irrigation channels built by the Incas hundreds of years ago. Around the world, there's 1 billion people who depend on water for, or depend on glacier melt for their water. Most of those 1 billion people live in South America or Southeast Asia. They do not have the resources to pay for the water that they previously had for free. Precipitation patterns are shifting. This is a record of rainfall in Central Africa. It used to be that there was a consistent pattern of rain and drought. For a few years, it would be dry, and then for a few years, it would be wet. Since the 1970s, around about the time El Nino also shifted phase, there has been nothing but consistent drought. Taken in itself, we can't say that this is either human or natural pattern. These long-term cycles happen all the time. But what we can do is we can look for consistency around the world. And what we do see around the entire world is that the dry areas are getting drier and the wet areas are getting wetter. Health risks are on the rise. This is a map of deaths attributed to climate change in the year 2000 by the World Health Organization. If you remember the map I showed you before, this is pretty much the inverse of that map. So immediately you can see that the countries most responsible for the problem are the countries who are bearing the least of the consequences. This number had already doubled by 2009. In 2009, the World Health Organization recorded 300,000 deaths, and it's estimated that there's 300 million people already at risk from climate change. Whether they live in 20 out of the world's largest cities that are within a meter of sea level, whether they live in marginal agricultural areas that are becoming drier and drier. We are already concerned about this relatively small temperature increase we've seen, 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit, 0.76 degrees Celsius. This is what we've seen so far. But this is what we expect in the future. And that is why we are so concerned. By the time we get into the future, it's too late to say, whoa, stop, I didn't really want this. It's kind of like dining out on a solid meal of pizza and McDonald's for 50 years of your life, ending up on the operating table, ready to crack your chest open for quadruple bypass surgery, and you say, hang on, I didn't mean it. I really don't want this. I promise that I will diet and I will exercise. Just let me off the table. Unfortunately, it doesn't work under that circumstance, and it's not going to work for us either under this circumstance. If we expand this so it doesn't look quite so scary, we see that we have a very narrow window of time to determine how climate change will affect our own generation and future generations. If we could flip a magic switch and turn everything off today, which is impossible, but it's a good thought experiment. If we could do that, we would still see another 1 degree Fahrenheit temperature increase because of what we've already put into the atmosphere. If we can reduce our emissions about 80% by 2050, actually that's probably increased to 85 now because every year we continue on a high pathway, adds a bit more to what we have to reduce. If we could reduce our emissions about 85% by 2050, we would end up on the lower pathway. If we continue to depend on fossil fuels, we'll be on that higher pathway. Let me show you what that means, because looking at these global numbers, it doesn't really translate to where we live. So I'm just going to show you two examples of what it means for the places where we live. This is a map of the number of weeks per year that we typically get over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. This is during the historical period, I think, of 1960 to 1990. As you can see, Texas bears most of it, and California gets its share. If we can manage to reduce our emissions significantly, 80% by 2050, this is still what it's going to look like by the time our children reach the end of the century. If we continue on our current pathway, depending on fossil fuels as our primary energy source, this is what it will look like. This is a little bit different than thinking that global temperature will increase by 10 degrees. This really brings it home what it would mean: Death Valley-like conditions spreading across most of Arizona and much of Texas. Conditions currently in Texas all the way up to Minnesota. Another way to look at this is what I call a migrating state diagram. We have one for Ontario too, so maybe we'll call it a migrating region diagram. What we did was we asked the same question. We said, what would a summer in Illinois, in terms of heat and humidity, what would it feel like under lower emissions in the future? That's the yellow. And what would it feel like under higher? That's the red. We asked the same question here for the New York tri-state area. And what we see is that summers are getting warmer and more humid, but the speed at which that happens depends significantly on the choices that we make. We have the power, by acting very soon, to actually mitigate a great deal of the expected change. I tell everybody who asks me why I moved to Texas that I did it to anticipate global warming. I'm already there, it can't hurt me. So we've seen the problem. And this is the problem that I look at every day. So now, what would you do when confronted by this problem? Here is what we have done. In the 1990s, our emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases, converted into carbon dioxide equivalent, were growing at about 1% per year. In the 2000s, they grew on average at 3% per year. There was a great deal of hope during the economic slowdown in 2008 that we might be on a downward path, but as you can see, it was just a momentary check, and the upward rise continued this past year. All of the future scenarios we look at confirm, at least in my mind, the idea that we scientists are inherently conservative. This is the full range of the future scenarios that we consider when we look at possible climate impacts. But if you look at this line, we are heading above even the highest future emissions. Now, you may say, at some point, we are going to run out of traditional fossil fuel resources. Yes, we will. But anybody who's in a geology department knows that there's a lot more out there than what we call traditional resources. If we wanted to live off non-traditional fossil resources, we could do so for many, many decades and even centuries in the future. So just because, as someone once said, the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stone, I don't think we can hope that the fossil fuel age will end because we run out of fossil fuels. At the same time, as all of these impacts have been accelerating, doubt regarding the seriousness of global warming is at an all-time high. Over the last 11 or 12 years, Gallup has been asking people this exact same question. In your view, is the seriousness of global warming exaggerated, correct, or underestimated? It goes up and down over time, but people's opinions hit an all-time high of doubtfulness in 2009. These perceptions, at least in the United States, tend to run along party lines. The dark green are the Republicans, self-identified Republicans. The middle green is independents, and the light green is Democrats. Again, we see all of these lines rising, but there's a big difference between 66% versus 22%. What really saddens me, though, is this next statistic. And that is the fact that these divisions also run along religious lines. This is a study by the Pew Forum done in 2008. They asked people, is there solid evidence the Earth is warming? People were allowed to have four answers. They could say, yes, because of human activity, which is what science says. They could say yes because of natural patterns, yes, but we don't know why, or no. As you can see, as we go down, unaffiliated, people who do not identify with any specific church or faith group, those people have the highest rate of actually agreeing with the science. Mainline Protestant churches and Catholics are next. Then you get down into black Protestants, and at the very bottom, we have white evangelical Protestants. 34% agree. In other words, 66% do not. There's a really interesting study done by a colleague of mine called Tony Lizowitz at Yale, where they surveyed people. And they found that you could characterize most of the people in America into six groups based on their perspective about global warming. The study was done a couple of years ago, so the different proportions of the groups might have changed a little bit. I imagine there's been some shifting in that direction over time. But what he found, very interestingly, is that there are some very coherent structures and characteristics to these groups. People in the middle tend to have traditional religious views, and they are not certain that global warming is real. As you go towards the end, they tend to have more conservative religious views and tend to be certain that it is not real. There's a big difference between those two positions. So then we get to the question that I ask myself a lot. Why is this happening? We could get into issues of the traditional divide between science and faith in America. We could talk about the monkey trials. We could talk about the ongoing debate between creation and evolution. There is, without doubt, an abiding schism, I think, between faith and science in America. There have been many books written about that, and there's many people in this room who know a lot more about it than I do. So rather than talking about that issue in general, what I'm going to do is I want to offer a couple of ideas that I have thought about, that I've heard people talk about, and that I've experienced in my own life as to why, with climate change, there's even more reasons for this divide to happen, besides the traditional one of the distrust between faith and science. Starting off with what we agree on. What really amazes me is that we agree on some very fundamental things, and this is all that we really need to agree on, I think, on climate change. Nearly all of us who would identify ourselves as Christians believe that in some way, shape, or form, God created the earth, and it is good. We would also agree, I would hope, that the Earth sustains our physical existence. Unless you plan on moving to Mars or the Moon, this is all we've got. We also read in Genesis that Adam was given the responsibility to care for God's creation. Most of us would agree it's important to respect God's creation, simply from the fact that if someone who you love and respect gives you a gift, you do not throw it in the trash. And most people would also agree that it's important to conserve. Conservation is a value that maybe not we don't practice enough, but we all agree is a good thing. This is all we have to agree on in terms of the theology about climate change, to agree that it's a real issue and we need to do something about it. So given this fundamental nature, this very basic nature that doesn't involve any schisms between different types of Baptists or any of the traditional divides between denominations, why do we still have this deep conflict? Well, here's a couple of reasons. First of all, the science of climate change is complex, and many of the more obvious effects, like melting Arctic sea ice and flooding tropical islands, cannot be seen in our own backyards. In our backyards, the sky is blue, the grass is green, and everything looks pretty good. Yeah, I heard that. It's true, in Texas it is not green. What we often do see in the backyard can be counterintuitive. This is a really interesting thing. Climate change can actually lead to stronger snowstorms. As temperature increases, simply put, the air can hold more water vapor. And so in the summer of 2009, I was a co-author on a report by the U.S. Global Change Research Program, and we said in that report that the Northeast U.S. can expect more severe snowstorms because of climate change. We did not do that in a spirit of prediction or prophecy, but what happened that winter was Snowmageddon. Philadelphia, I think, received 200-year snowstorms in 1 year. I was unfortunately trapped in Washington, D.C. for one of its snowstorms and just about put my back out trying to shovel out the driveway. But at the same time, all these people were making fun of climate change, saying, here's this huge snowstorm, how on earth could this happen? It's because it's very counterintuitive. How could global warming lead to a huge snowstorm? What we had in Texas last year was we had the coldest winter on record in Texas. How did we have that? What happened was, up in the Arctic, there was record ice loss in the winter in the Arctic. Some places in the Arctic were 40 degrees Fahrenheit above average. They had to cancel dog sled races in the Arctic in the winter because they didn't have enough snow. We could have shipped them some from Texas. They didn't take us up on the offer. So what happens is normally it is so cold in the Arctic that it is essentially sealed off from the rest of the planet. All of that really cold air stays in the Arctic. But this time the temperature gradient was so weak between the Arctic and the rest of the country that all of those Arctic air masses that didn't seem so cold to them, but it sure seemed cold to Texas, those cold Arctic air masses went right down the side of the Rockies all the way to West Texas. So again, there is certainly a connection between cold weather that we've been having and climate change. But how can you explain that to people? It just doesn't make sense. There's another reason, I believe, why science and faith are in conflict, and that is the fact that we can't deny that there is a well-funded disinformation campaign at work. It is very similar to what was run back in the days when people were trying to connect cancer to smoking. It involves some of the exact same people as were involved in that too. They have stated goals of muddying the science of climate change, of promoting the idea that the science is not settled, of actively opposing any legislation to limit emissions, and unfortunately, more recently, of discrediting or discouraging scientists themselves. I am very far from being a conspiracy theorist. I tend to really reject all that stuff. But what I'm saying here is actually based on my own experience. I know these people, I have seen these people, I have seen them in court under oath, and I have seen the documents myself, tracking the money and tracking their plans. So if you're interested in finding out more about this, there's two really good books that came out this past year that actually talk in great detail about how this is actually going on. Unfortunately, there's more. There are errors, and in some cases even I would go so far as to call them lies, that are being propagated by sources that Christians trust. Most of them are errors, most of them are things that people just don't know better, but unfortunately, a recent survey showed, for example, that 60% of pastors don't think that this is a real issue. 100% of GOP candidates in the last election deny its reality. Every GOP candidate who's running for president has denied it, including ones in the past who said it was real. Conservative news pundits regularly ridicule climate science. And unfortunately, even some Christian groups actively participate in spreading false information. This video here is a good example. It promises to be a scientific and biblical exposé of climate change. And so I actually took the time to watch the whole thing, and it was more horrifying than any horror movie that you could ever see. As a scientist, to see people who you knew better, I knew they did, lying through their teeth to brothers and sisters in Christ about this very important issue, horrified me. Lastly, there's psychology. Climate change is a daunting problem. It is. Even thinking about it can be overwhelming. This is not a picture of me on my bad days, but it could be. Doing something about it could limit or constrain goods and rights that we hold dear, especially in the United States. Nobody wants their rights to be constrained in any way. Psychology tells us that it's often a lot easier to deny the reality of a problem than to do something about it. That's what every issue is about. You have to admit you're an alcoholic before you can seek help. You have to admit a certain type of addiction before you can get help to it. In the same way, we are addicted to these old, dirty ways of getting energy, and we have to admit that addiction before we can seek help, and that is a very frightening step. It really is. So these are four reasons that I offer for your consideration. I don't think any one of them individually is the main reason. I think it really is a mix of it for each one of us, and there's probably even a few more out there. But as a scientist, I like to be a little idealistic, and I believe that there is truth. And I believe also that the truth can set us free. I recognize that that verse was not specifically talking about climate change. But I think that regardless of the reasons why we have doubts about climate change, we are believing some things that are not true. And by learning that they are not true, I think that that can be a first step towards moving towards a better understanding of this issue. What do I mean by these myths? Well, I mean the things that you hear, the things that you hear from Uncle Joe at Thanksgiving dinner, or from your neighbor as you wash the car, or from your colleague in the elevator at work. One of the things you hear frequently, I get this a lot, is it's cooling, it's not warming. If you draw a straight line from 1998, which was a very, very warm year, to 2008, and you ignore all the data in between, it's not a linear fit, it's literally connecting two dots. You do get a line that goes down. And so people have actually used this, I kid you not, to say that it is getting cooler. Whereas in reality, of course, when you draw a line, you have to draw that line as a linear trend fitting every single data point, whether you like it or not. And unfortunately, when you do that, even for that period, you get a line that is going up, not down. This is one of the favorites you get anywhere. It's freezing outside. Where's global warming? Somehow we have the idea that every day should be like Florida under global warming, or San Diego. Weather is how conditions change from day to day, or even from year to year. It is unpredictable. We can have very warm years, or we can have very cold years. We can't predict the weather. But what we don't realize is that climate is the average statistics of weather over multiple decades, and it can actually be quite predictable. Climate is not inherently chaotic. It is driven by changes in the energy balance of the Earth. And if we know what is causing those changes in the energy balance, we can actually predict climate. It's very similar to saying, I have no idea when I'm going to die. But if I looked at women born in the year I was born with my same socioeconomic and racial heritage, I could pin down to within a year or two when on average I should die, right? So it's the same way. Weather is not knowing when you individually are going to die. It's a bad example, really. And then climate is knowing that as a group, the average is going to be plus or minus 1 year. From 105, of course. Okay, so people say, all right, fine. Okay, it's warming. I will let you off the hook. I will say it is warming. But the reason why it's warming is because we have thermometers that used to be out in the country, and now they're in cities, right? And everybody knows cities are warmer than the country. That's true. Well, if that's the case, then it should be getting warmer faster in the places where people live, right? And it should be getting warmer a lot slower, not at all, in the places where nobody lives. So here's a map of the world at night. It's a composite image a visual image where the lights actually show where people live. Those are the real lights. Here's a map of where it's getting warmer. Not a very good match, is it? There are no large urban populations up in northwest Canada. Similarly, there's not a lot up in northern Russia either. You can actually plot urban versus non-urban stations, and you can see that they both show exactly the same warming trend. Because we've known about the urban heat island effect for over 200 years, and it is removed from the data before calculating the trends. There is another culprit, though. The culprit that has caused just about all of our climate change in the past, and that is the sun. So it's a really good question to ask, couldn't it be the sun that's causing our climate change right now? We have, fortunately, some pretty good records. We have records of how much insulation or energy we've been getting from the sun here over the past 130 years. You see the 11-year sunspot cycle there, and you see the long-term trend. Since the 1970s, we've actually been getting less energy from the sun. In fact, we are just coming out of a solar minimum that was unprecedented since the Little Ice Age in the late 1700s. We can look at solar activity also. There's some theories that cosmic rays are related to temperature on the Earth. And we see again that it has also been decreasing since the 1970s. And then superimposing over this, our Earth's temperature. Our temperature has been increasing faster since the 1960s when the sun's energy has been going down. So the sun has a perfect alibi. In fact, the sun has actually been helping us out. We would be about 7% warmer right now if it weren't for the decrease in solar energy. Another common one we hear is, aren't plants to blame more than us? And if you look at the global carbon cycle, it's true. The biosphere produces about 100 gigatons of carbon a year. The ocean produces about 115 gigatons of carbon a year. And we humans produce about 8 or 9. So 200 gigatons, natural sources, and 9 gigatons, human sources. How could we affect something as big as our planet? The answer is in the sinks. The ocean absorbs just as much or more carbon dioxide than it produces. The biosphere does the same. Humans are the only source that do not absorb anything, and it builds up in the atmosphere. Well, we talked about natural cycles before, so I'll just show this again. We can't blame natural cycles because no matter how far back we look in time, we have not seen any natural cycles like we see today. They just don't exist. If you go back 65 million years ago, you do see a time period when CO2 was as high as it was today, but the continents were in a very different configuration than today, and there was very different volcanic activity and very different solar insolation during that time. And then one that we also get that we know is just the silliest one is that it is such a small amount of gases. How could it actually affect the atmosphere? And then you just kind of say, well, it's just a small amount of poison. How could it affect your body? The size doesn't matter. It's the potency that matters. And we are producing some fairly potent gases that happen to have absorption lines in the atmospheric window. The atmospheric window is the only range of wavelength where the Earth's infrared radiation can escape to space. But these gases are important because they have absorption lines specifically in that window. And that is why they can have such a disproportionately large effect despite their very small concentrations. Some people say that there's actually a scientific consensus against climate change. There was a myth going around a few years ago that you still might hear that there were 17,000 qualified scientists who signed something called the Oregon Petition that claimed that global warming had no scientific basis. I managed to get a hold of a copy of the petition. It was sent to everybody in my department except me. Somebody gave it to me, and I read it, and it actually said, is climate change already causing catastrophic impacts? That's the question it asked, which is not the same question as it said it asked. I don't know if I would answer that one. I mean, if I was in Alaska, I would say yes, but, you know, living in Texas, actually, I would say I'm not sure yet. Scientific American did the legwork and identified that about 200 people of those were actually legitimate. They had legitimate degrees of any kind. But only a handful of those were in relevant fields. Other signees included the Spice Girls, Perry Mason, and John Grisham. Probably not the real John Grisham. The truth is that 98% of active scientists in related fields agree that climate change is occurring and that most of it is the result of human emissions of heat-trapping gases. And as we all know, getting 98% of scientists to agree on the color of the sky is a pretty big feat, let alone agreeing on a statement like this. Scientists are still arguing, people say, and we love to argue. Who doesn't love a good argument? But what amazes me is the incredible consensus that we see. If we look at these two statements, the first statement is from the last report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, published in 2007. The new report is just on its way. I got the first draft, I think, this week. But this statement says that warming of the climate system is now evident, most of it due to the increase in heat-trapping gases from human activities. The second statement says almost the same thing, doesn't it? It says that climate change is being brought about by human-induced increases in carbon dioxide, primarily through combustion or burning of fossil fuels. This second statement was from a paper by a British engineer in 1938. The very first climate model was constructed and calculated by hand by a Swedish chemist in 1890. It took him a year to finish the calculations. His wife left him. He finished on Christmas Day, alone. Maybe for the first time he realized he was alone. Anybody else ever had that experience? Your family just leaves without you. But the calculations that he made with that hand-calculated climate model of how temperature in the Arctic and temperature around the world would increase with carbon dioxide were amazingly and humblingly similar to what our most powerful supercomputers are telling us today. That is the awesome consensus on climate change. So how do we know that it's us? Putting all these myths aside, the real question is, okay, it's happening, how do we know? What we would really like to have is a second planet in our lab. We cannot get that, and so what we do is we do the next best thing. We create that second planet. We create a virtual world using the most powerful supercomputers available to us. Every time a new supercomputer becomes available, there's a new climate model waiting to be run on it. Using these climate models that are based on the fundamental physical equations of conservation of energy and mass and momentum, the dynamics that control the circulation of the ocean and the atmosphere, using these models that contain all of the physics that we know, and increasingly all of the chemistry and all of the biology also that we know, using these models, we can actually simulate a world with no people. We can. We put in volcanic eruptions that temporarily cool the Earth. We put in variations in energy from the sun that go up and down from year to year. We put in all the natural cycles like El Nino and the North Atlantic Oscillation. And when we do that, this is what we get. The black line there is the real temperature of our world. All the blue lines are the different 25 climate models around the world running that world with no people. The vertical lines are every time we have a volcanic eruption, it cools the Earth for a couple of years. If it was big enough and high enough. There's a really good match between the real world and the models up until about 1960. After 1960, that Earth with no people should be getting cooler because it was getting less energy from the sun. In a balanced system, you can't have something heating up if it's got less inputs. Now, we run the exact same models with the exact same natural variability in them. The only difference is we add human emissions of heat-trapping gases. That is the only difference. And this is what we get. There is no way to explain what is happening to our planet if you leave humans out of the equation. So, given all of this, time to put our brains aside and bring our hearts into it a little bit. Why should I care? Why should I personally care? Why should I care about this for the sake of my family and my friends and my community and for the sake of the planet that God created? Well, Jesus tells us, he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And then he says, to love your neighbor as yourself. Today, it's our neighbors who are already being harmed by climate change. We're seeing rising sea levels, widespread droughts, and rapidly disappearing glaciers that are already today threatening millions of people with loss of water and food and even their lives. Today, it's our global neighbors, it's the people who are poor and disadvantaged, even though they may be strangers to us. Those are the people who are most vulnerable to harm from climate-related impacts. Look at what happened during Katrina. We can't say that Katrina was because of climate change. We do expect more severe hurricanes, but you can't pin any one event on climate change. But let's look at what happened. Who was harmed by Katrina? Was it the wealthy people who could afford to get out and who could afford to rebuild when they came back? No. It was the poor and the vulnerable and the disadvantaged, the elderly and the sick and the young. Those were the people who were harmed by a natural disaster. And that is what we are seeing today around the world. It is the people who have the least resources, the people that we give to World Vision to support, or Compassion International. We are putting our money into a bucket with a larger and larger hole in the bottom, and that hole is climate change. John Holden said this a long time ago before he was corrupted by politics. He said, and I agree, we have three choices. We can mitigate, we can adapt, or we can suffer. We are going to do some of each. The question is what the mix is going to be. The more mitigation we do, that's reducing our emissions now and conserving our natural resources, the less adaptation will be required and the less suffering there will be. So for that reason, I argue that the sensible response to climate change is to reduce our own contribution, to minister to the hurting, and to love our global neighbors as ourselves. It really is an issue of love because it's gotten to the point where people are being affected today. Whether it's the citizens of Kivalina who are losing their homes, or the people in India who will soon be deprived of water resources that they need for agriculture and for survival. So what can we do? I always like to end with something practical. We are educators, and there is a lot to do with education. These are two of my favorite tools that I really love, and I wanted to share them with you. This is a website called Skeptical Science. It's an iPhone app also for those of you who are technologically inclined. You can get it on your phone. It's put together by a guy called John Cook in Australia, who is also a Christian. And what he has done is he has tracked every single question and myth that there is about climate change. And he provides a very short elevator answer, if you have that 30 seconds in the elevator with your colleague. But then underneath that elevator answer, he provides a very long answer with links to all of the journal articles, full citations, and all of the relevant figures. If you're interested in what climate scientists are actually discussing, this is another great site, Real Climate, founded by some of the top climate scientists in the world, where they make posts every day about things that they think are interesting. Anytime a new study comes out that they're interested in or that has potentially new results, they discuss it here, and there's very, very lively discussions that go on, and anybody is welcome to post, as long as it's not offensive. At the same time, we can do what our grandparents told us to do, and we can conserve. We can conserve the resources we have, and we can protect ourselves from what we can. In West Texas, we get our water from an aquifer. The aquifer has gone down more than 150 feet since 1950 when they started to irrigate. Most of the aquifer has less than 30 years left. That has nothing to do with climate change. It has to do with the fact that nobody put a price on the water, so everybody's using it up as fast as they can. It just makes sense to conserve, because when you add climate change onto it, warmer temperatures mean faster evaporation, so you need more water to get the same amount of irrigation, and you're going to be using it up faster than 30 years. So there's a lot of sensible things that we can do, even if we don't think climate change is a problem. We can reduce our own impact. This may look like the silliest example in the world. Everybody's heard about this example, replacing your light bulbs. Does it really work? If every U.S. household replaced one light bulb, it would be the same as taking a million cars off the road. If we replaced all of our light bulbs, that would be enough to stop the increase in heat-trapping gases from U.S. sources. Light bulbs. I kid you not. Now, that's not enough to get us to where we need to go. There's a lot more we can do. But it's about small steps. We think, in the back of our minds, that doing something about climate change is about pulling the plug on everything. No TV. No showers. No air conditioning. No car. You live in Texas without a car. That's pretty tough. It's not. It's about starting with what we have and then making it known that we want more. We live in a consumer-based society, and in some cases, that can actually work for us. We need more of those products. But ultimately, we have to support fundamental change. We have to wean ourselves off of the dirty, inefficient, and old ways of getting energy. These ways of getting energy pollute our air. They pollute our water. They increase our dependence on foreign energy sources, and they do not invest in our own economy. So again, even if you think climate change is a complete crock, there is every reason in the world to start pursuing alternative sources of energy that God has given us that will never run out. And the good news is that it's happening. This is actually a picture taken from just south of where we live in Texas. Rusting oil rigs are being replaced by fields full of hundreds of wind turbines. Built on the land of ranchers who couldn't care less about climate change, it just makes good financial sense. So why not? And that's it. Thank you very much. Sure, we have time for a few questions if anybody has one. Yes, Randy.
You commented on several reasons why conservative Christians or Christians in general are doubtful or denying climate change. And I wonder why you did not mention any specifically religious aspects. But if I might suggest an answer that you may comment on, I think there is a mistaken belief that God has guaranteed
I completely agree with you. If I had another hour, I could probably add a lot more reasons. There's reasons like, if the planet is going to be destroyed, why not just take what we have while the going's good? You know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow it's gone. You also have points like, if God is in control, then he's not going to let anything happen that would hurt us. Which is, of course, silly if you've ever heard of somebody who had a child killed or any other disaster happen in their lives. And then there's the whole dominion theology where, rather than taking care of the planet, is given to us to use in any way we see fit. So there is a whole host of specifically religious-based arguments, I would say. I wouldn't want to call them biblically-based, but religiously-based arguments that I would, again, put into that myth category. And I agree, there's a lot more. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. I haven't been stoned yet, but I've seen the vegetables once or twice.
How would you respond to this statement? If we spend hundreds of billions of dollars and make a concerted effort to cut down CO2 emissions, it will have almost no effect unless we can get other countries following our footsteps.
That is a good question. The question was, sorry, I'm going to tickle my throat here. We could spend a very large amount of money cutting our own CO2 emissions, but if the rest of the world doesn't join us, there's no point, essentially. It's a very common argument, but here's what people don't realize. Much of the world is already cutting their emissions, and the U.S. is in grave danger of falling behind in the technology race. The richest man in China makes solar panels. The European Union already has a price on carbon and is committed to reducing their emissions 80% by 2050. Other countries see the writing on the wall, and they are moving towards green and sustainable technologies. I'm not advocating that, you know, pull the plug, cold turkey, you know, stop using everything immediately. I think that makes no sense. But I think there's a lot of sensible things we can do that would invest in the economy at the same time. There's a lot of analyses, and I'm sorry I don't have the reference here right now, but if you email me, I can give it to you. There's analyses on if you factor in all of the, not just the cost, but the benefits of investing in green technology, the numbers you get are very different than the numbers people are tossing around as to just the raw cost without considering the benefit that you reap from it. But I'm not an economist. You'll have to get an economist next time. Yes, over there, and then here.
Damage to the climate. What do you think of that kind of proposal? Have you seen that proposal?
Yeah. What you're referring to is something called geoengineering, which is basically engineering the planet. There's a really good National Academy report on that topic that I'd recommend, because there's a couple of different things people have been using. Like, they've been putting iron filings into the ocean to increase the ocean absorption of CO2. And they've also talked about that option of shooting basically aerosol particles high enough into the atmosphere that they would stay there for long enough to reflect significant amounts of radiation. Geoengineering scares me. How well have we done in geoengineering the planet so far? The last time they had something like that, last time there was a major volcanic eruption, which is what typically causes all those particles naturally to occur, there were crop failures around the world. There was major reductions in solar energy reaching the surface of the Earth, which we need for other reasons. It altered the weather patterns. It had a host of unforeseen consequences. It kind of reminds me of you take one of those miracle drugs that are supposed to reduce your blood pressure. It gives you 25 side effects. Before you know it, you're carrying around bags of pills so large you need a separate suitcase to cover all the side effects of the pills you're already taking. So, I mean, people speculate that it may get to the point where we'll be desperate enough where we have to try that. But let's try to conserve. Let's try to do things that make sense and don't have bad consequences before we start messing with something as big as our planet. The moon is just not an attractive place to live. Yes? Yeah, that's an excellent question, comparing this to the ozone hole. I think we can. I actually wrote a whole chapter in the book about how we can learn from the ozone hole. What happened was the ozone hole was being caused by specific chemicals in spray cans and coolants. And the problem was identified by scientists, and the world government acted very, very quickly. They held a protocol meeting in 1990 where it was agreed to reduce the use of these chemicals. And as of last year, the hole has bottomed out and has started on its way back up. So it is an enormous success story. So why can't we do that again? Well, unfortunately, telling people that they have to have a different spray can is a little different than telling people that you have to have a whole different way of getting all of your energy. The magnitude of the problem is, I don't know, 1,000, a million times greater. So while I think we could learn from the attitudes and the mechanisms a lot, there is a massive unwillingness to do so that has to be overcome that was not there for the ozone hole issue. But that was a huge success, I think, of collaboration between science and policy. Sure. I hope so. There is an organization called Republicans for Environmental Protection. They're a wonderful organization, and I love them. But whenever I mention their name, people laugh. I just hope that through our faith is the way to do that. Because most GOP candidates now identify themselves as Christians in some way, shape, or form. And if we can realize that this is about a planet that God created, it's about people that God created who are suffering, and it's about sensible choices that we can make using the brain that God gave us, I just hope that rather than letting our politics inform our faith, we can actually start allowing our faith to inform our politics. That's my prayer. Because I don't see any other way to do it. At the back there. Typically, when you see those type of articles, and I know the article that you're referring to, nobody go look it up, okay? They're typically written by people who it's not their primary field of research, but they've been so successful in their career, and they're generally towards the towards the end of their career rather than the beginning. They've been so successful in their career that I think that a little bit of hubris takes over, and they start to think that they can understand everything even though it isn't their primary area of study. And usually, when I looked at that article, for example, when I look at those articles, there's a fundamental misconception you can identify almost at once if you've really looked into this. But it's hard to convince people of that. Freeman Dyson is another person who's kind of gone in that direction. It's kind of like, and this happens all the time, but you know, it's kind of like you have an allergist you go to and you really trust your allergist, and then your allergist says, you know what, I can do open heart surgery, I'm really good at it, I'm a doctor. You know, and you say, no, thank you. We have to apply that same filter when we read things written by people. Now, that said, there are a handful of scientists, and I could probably count them on one hand, literally, who do have degrees in the right fields and who do publish occasionally in the literature in the field. And yet they still will go on TV. They won't stand up at scientific conferences, but they will go on TV, or they will talk to public audiences if they know a scientist isn't there. And they will say, you know, this thing isn't real. It's just invented by the United Nations trying to take away our freedom. They will give people all that spiel. There's only a few of them, and I spent quite a while trying to think about what motivates them, because a few of them actually identify as Christians, too. They make a big point about being Christians. And I think with each of them, there's different reasons. Different personal reasons where, in one case, you know, somebody was very wrong about something, and they got hounded by the community, so it kind of embittered them towards the community, and they got accepted by the skeptics, so that's kind of their home now. Other people just kind of, they like being obstinate. We just love to argue. Some people kind of carry that to the extreme. But there's just a very small handful of names that get disproportionate coverage, and so we think there's more than there are. I think there was one more question. Yeah, one more question over there, yeah. I am. After watching the DVD I referred to earlier, it sent my blood pressure so far through the roof that my husband got delegated to watch all the other ones. So he had the pleasure of watching that one, as well as the global warming hoax, and the not evil, not just wrong, and the whole list of other ones. But those just sadden me. I mean, what really saddens me is the way that our community is being targeted by people who are frankly unscrupulous. We are being fed lies. In some cases, they are errors, they are honest errors, but in some cases, and I would put that DVD in that category, they are deliberate twisting of facts, deliberate creation of things that are not true, targeted at the Christian community. And as Christian scientists, I think that we are the only ones, I think, who have the ability to stand up and say, that is not true, and I will tell you why. I don't know who else can do that. I will leave you with that challenge.